The Italian Wine Podcast is the community-driven platform for Italian wine geeks around the world. Support the show by donating at italianwinepodcast.com. Donate 5 or more euros and we'll send you a copy of our latest book, My Italian Grape Geek Journal, absolutely free. To get your free copy of My Italian Grape Geek Journal, click support us at italianwinepodcast.com or wherever you get your pods. Grazie mille.
Welcome to the Italian Wine Podcast Book Club. Each month, we select a great wine book to share. We chat to the author and get your opinions. Stay tuned as we read Between the Vines with the Italian Wine Podcast. Hello and welcome to Book Club with the Italian Wine Podcast. This is the third episode of a new show focusing on the world of wine writing. Each month, we choose a book, chat to the author, listen to some extracts and explore the story behind the book. We'd really like your ideas and suggestions too. So if there's a wine book or a wine writer that you'd like us to feature, please let us know. Last month, we received a message from Barbara Fitzgerald, whose family are among the great Californian wine industry pioneers. And here's what she said. Last year, I read Robert Camuto's new book called South of Somewhere, which is all about the magic of wine and people in the south of Italy. Each chapter focuses on a different region and a producer who is not just making wine, but often defying the odds. The way Robert talks about the beauty and the culture in the south sent chills up my spine. He also talks about growing up in the US as an Italian American and what it feels like to travel back to Italy to see family. At times, I felt like he was telling my own story. So to Barbara and everyone else listening, I'm delighted to introduce today's guest, Robert Camuto. Hi, Robert. How are you?
Hi. Great. Great. That was a fantastic message from Barbara.
Yes. I thought you'd like that as a way just to...
Yes.
To...
Thank you, Barbara.
Okay, so Robert is a journalist from New York City. In 2001, he moved to southern France with his family. And the result of that experience was Corkscrewed, Adventures in the New French Wine Country, which was published in 2008. He then shifted his attention to Italy and published Palmento, a Sicilian wine odyssey in 2010. In 2015, he moved to Verona, where he lives and works to this day. He's a contributing editor for Wine Spectator magazine and writes a regular column, Robert Camuto Meets. We will discuss your most recent book, South of Somewhere, Wine, Food and the Soul of Italy, shortly. But first, I wanted to explore that experience of growing up as an Italian American. Your father, I think, Robert, was born on the Upper East Side in 1936, the son of Sicilian migrants.
Lower East.
Lower East Side,
those
sorry.
Those who know the difference.
There's a distinction, is there?
Yes.
Maybe that's difference. Something we can get
uptown
into.
Uptown and downtown.
Okay. he went on to become what the New York Times described as a shoe mogul and a quiet titan of retail. Your latest book, South of Somewhere, is dedicated to your maternal grandparents, Raffaele and Concetta, who were born in Vico Equense, a small town on a dramatic cliff overlooking the Bay of Naples. They too emigrated to New York between the wars. So can you give us some kind of insight into their lives, what brought them to New York City in the 1920s, and what it was like for them as migrants from the south of Italy?
Well, if we talk about their story, it's a fairly typical story. I mean, Italian immigrants between the wars came out of desperation, if nothing else.
Yeah.
Their goal was to work and establish themselves in America. They learned American on the boat. You know, I think in many ways, my upbringing wasn't really, I would say, Italian American. I grew up as an American kid. My parents moved a lot, et cetera, et cetera. But I think through my grandparents, I was able to experience some of that old culture, especially around the table, you know, everything around the meal. In fact, as I note in the book, my grandfather, my maternal grandfather, in his deli in New York, his Italian delicatessen, he had for a while made wine in the basement. Like many Italian American grape trucks came in from California,
yeah.
And they, you know, made their own personal wine, which is something that I think really caught on during the Prohibition years in America. It was a big thing because during Prohibition, while the sale of wine and alcohol was prohibited, wine for personal usage was allowed for personal family use, because otherwise I think many of these workers would have found life impossible working in mines in Minnesota. And interestingly, not something I write about, but I've read about in the, for example, the biography of the Mondavis, that was how the Mondavi family got their start, was the Father Cesare, who had been selected by their town in Minnesota, a mining town in Minnesota, to go get grapes in California. And that's how they discovered grapes, because if you could imagine working in a mine or in Minnesota, or working on a skyscraper in New York, you know, those are many of the jobs, mining construction jobs, that many of the southern migrants that were in the eastern part of the United States did. You know, doing that without having a little bit of vino, you know, at home in the evening with your meal would have made life a lot more grim.
Absolutely. I can imagine if you're in a job like that, a little glass of wine that reminds you of home is just what you need.
Yes, yes. And of course, you know, we grew up around my grandmother's table. It was always a time of, you know, celebration. And Italian-American immigrants didn't so much make a, you know, Italian pure food, because many of the ingredients were impossible to get. So, you know, famously, they adapted a lot of the recipes to what was available out of my grandmother's kitchen, which was the size of a postage stamp in New York City. You know, she really, you know, created wonderful creations that brought everybody together.
Yeah, I mean, I'm getting a real strong sense of your Italian origins there, even though, as you said, you grew up more or less as an American rather than Italian. I suppose for you, a turning point, if I read correctly from your book, was this experience in 1968 as a 10-year-old child from New York, that magical summer where you spent in the Bay of Naples with your extended family. And you paint a really vivid picture of that experience in the introduction of South of Somewhere, talking about your extended family, how they look, how they dress, what they eat. Can you relive some of that for us and give us a sense of what that was like for a 10-year-old boy coming from New York City?
Yes. So again, when I was 10, I went with my grandmother and my cousins back to Vico Equense, this gorgeous town on the Mediterranean overlooking the Bay of Naples, which incidentally, I note that every year when they do these polls in Italy of what are the most romantic places to be married in Italy, et cetera, et cetera, Vico Equense is always in the top one or two or places.
Yeah, just behind Verona.
Anyway, returning to Vico Equense with my grandmother and cousins in 1968, I was 10 years old, and spent the summer there really down at a restaurant along the sea. It was the only restaurant at the time down in seaside Vico Equense, which is also known as Seano. The restaurant was called O Saracino, and it was connected to the family by marriage. And basically, I just remember spending time on the docks there, swimming off the docks, going out in rafts, eating ice cream, eating pizza, going up into town, playing ping pong, and, you know, the nights on the square. It was a whole lifestyle that I never experienced in my life before. And it was a beautiful time also to be in Italy, to be in the south of Italy. It was the boom period in the 60s. People were dressed beautifully. They had shiny little Fiats.
Yeah.
It was just a beautiful summer. And I remember any time I or my cousins would ask anything, can we do this, can we do that? The answer was always, why not? Why not? Sure. In fact, you know, I remember walking up the hillsides back to town from the seaside, and just the little memories really stick with me. Just, you know, the smell of olive fields, that kind of earthy, dusty smell. I remember an aunt's kitchen window where there were, you know, figs hanging out side the window, and the, you know, the smell of her little mocha making a coffee in the morning.
At that age, your senses are so finely tuned, and your memory of them, I think, as well, is incredible at that age. You remember, you store these memories for the rest of your life. I was struck reading that passage, actually. My wife has a similar experience in that she's Scots-Italian. She was born in Glasgow and grew up in the 1980s and come back to rural Tuscany and spend summers in rural Tuscany in a mountain village there. And she always speaks about that sense of freedom that she had that wasn't available to her growing up in Glasgow. But when she came back to Italy with her parents, for both the parents and the children, there was a sense of coming home and having a freedom that was different to their experience in the place where they migrated to.
Yes, and also this simplicity of life, which I think still persists in Italy. But, you know, we can hope that with all the development of, like, for example, onotourism, et cetera, things don't get too slick, too sophisticated.
Yeah, I mean, that's something I wanted to ask as well. You talk about this persistence of that way of life. And I wonder, has Italy, in a sense, lost those habits or those customs, that notion of extended family, of shared meals together with a carafe of wine on the table? And again, that's something from my experience. I remember with my parents-in-law, there would always be a bottle of wine on the table at lunchtime, at dinner time. Is that way of life at risk?
I don't think it's at risk, particularly in the South. I mean, at risk, who knows? But I think that, you know, if you look at Italy, is really probably three major areas with three distinct histories and three distinct cultures. I think there's the South, there's Central Italy, and the North, which we might divide in between Northeast and Northwest. But I think in the South, one of the distinct aspects of the culture is the individual is so important there. The person is so important. Not so much the business, but the person coming first. And it's just this incredible natural hospitality that just flows from the very beings of people. You know, the idea to make people eat well, the idea to accommodate them well, to care about their needs. I remember a couple of years ago, I was in the middle of Campania in Benevento area. It was a really hot afternoon, and I just wanted a nice glass of sparkling water. That's all I really wanted.
Going to say sparkling wine there, but no, sparkling water.
No. In the middle of the afternoon. I mean, there's enough wine when I travel generally at lunch, at dinner, so I just wanted that nice cold glass of water. And I sat down outside at a table, and you know, the barman came up and he brought back I said, I'd like a little San Pellegrino. And he said, Bianco o Rosso? I think he was confusing it with the Pellegrino winery in Sicily. But anyway, so he brings out a nice icy glass of water, a slice of lemon, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then when I went to pay, I said, how much do I owe you? And he shrugged and said, what, for water? Nothing.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think that is what one would find everywhere in Italy, certainly not everywhere in the world. In New York, that glass would cost $5 or something like that. So it's just this sense of welcome. And I remember that same day, I went by a restaurant to reserve in the evening, and the owner was just walking out the door, and he said, okay, come get a coffee with me. And I did. I went down to another bar and had an espresso there. So, you know, I think that that's something that one still finds in all of these individual stories in the South.
Okay, good. That's good to hear that those customs and traditions and that sense of hospitality that I've experienced as well, actually, the hospitality you can encounter there is unbelievable.
Yeah. Also, I was going to say, not long ago, I was back in Vico Equense for a reading that I did for the Italian edition of South of Somewhere that's called Altrove a Sud. My wife was there, my son was there. And in Vico Equense, some say it has the greatest concentration now of Michelin-starred restaurants. One of them is the successor to the O Saracino that I was talking about, that's Torre Saracino, that is run by Gennaro Esposito. And actually the proprietor of the place, of the walls, is my cousin Vittoria. But anyway, there's also a famous chef from Vico Equense. Well, there's more than one. There's Cannavacciuolo, also Beppe Guida. And Beppe Guida closes his restaurant in Vico Equense in summer. And the whole staff goes up into the hills, up into the mountains, the Monte Lateri, which are behind Vico Equense. It's separated from the Amalfi Coast. And they have a kind of an agriturismo there, and people go for Sunday lunch. We'd gone with our son. There was just the three of us. Beautiful views over the mountains, the coast, the sea. Fantastic. I explained to them our son had a plane to catch to go back to London, where he lives. I said, look, he has about an hour and a half, 2 hours maximum. And their response was, oh, well, you know, I don't know that that's possible. We're not McDonald's.
Yeah, you need at least 3 or 4 hours for lunch.
Yes. There were all these big families there that had gone up into the hills for Sunday lunch, and it was just absolutely gorgeous. And by the way, I believe that for antipasti, there were like 13 little things that came out one after another.
Yeah, amazing. This is probably a good time to do your first reading.
Okay.
Great.
So in this passage, I'm going to be talking a little bit about not just a personal story, but about the Italian wine producing South in general. Italy is not just the world's largest wine producer, but is also an endless source of stories. It also has a long and checkered wine history, from the spread of the vine through Europe during the Roman Empire to the modern post-war industrialization of vineyards and mass-scale cooperative wineries. Italy's movement to modern fine wine, which we recognize today on wine shop shelves and high-end restaurant wine lists, began in earnest only after a horrifying, deadly scandal shook the world's faith in Italian wine. In 1986, 20 people died and dozens were blinded after drinking inexpensive table wines fortified with poisonous quantities of methanol, a cheap wood alcohol commonly used to produce formaldehyde and automobile fuel additives. Ironically, the scandal was not centered in some poor southern province controlled by mafia bosses, but in northeastern Italy's esteemed and somewhat snobby Piedmont, close to France. It was also here, in a kind of grand-scale atonement, that the reset of Italian wines began. Making better wines meant not only oenologists, modern testing labs, good and clean equipment, and dedicated winemaking spaces, but also years of research in selecting varietals and studying soils. Perhaps the greatest challenge was a change of attitude, choosing to favor quality over quantity, transforming wine from a source of calories in the countryside to a source of exquisite pleasure in the cities where people now live has taken time, as has convincing old school contadini. Naturally, it took longer for some parts of the South to get the memo. Rural Southerners, long under the yoke of feudalism or the church, often lack the entrepreneurial instincts that benefit small-scale commercial winemaking. Up until a couple of generations ago, agriculture was a life of misery. Who had money to spend on wine? Thankfully, mentalities and opportunities have changed. Wine, like communication, was once controlled by a few who had access to investment technology and markets. In recent decades, as technology, access, and education have been democratized, so is winemaking. With even a small investment and a bit of time, good wine can be made anywhere you can grow good grapes. Italy's greatest strength is its culture of Renaissance. Not the Renaissance period, but the idea of inspired renewal in what may seem a very dark hour. So it was in wine. Today you find the spirit of Renaissance when a daughter of contadini uses her grandfather's grapes in some forgotten patch of countryside to launch her own wine label. Of course, it is one thing to make great wine and another to sell it. Thanks to new generations of adventurous wine drinkers from the United States, Northern Europe, and elsewhere across the globe, there is a growing thirst for new discoveries among old vineyards. While it's become popular to bash globalization, in fact, the wine world would dry up without it. One of the beautiful things about a connected world is that for the first time, the aforementioned daughter of Contadini in the deep south of Italy can develop an ardent following for her wines in Tokyo, London, Brooklyn, or Los Angeles. Italians need the world outside its borders to thrive. It's been that way for thousands of years. The world also needs Italians for their sense of beauty and design and their hands that make products including finished marble Ferraris and Ferrazzuoli pasta. Italians, with their high tolerance for chaos, also serve as an antidote to a very stressed out modern world. In one way or another, Italy's lifestyle has spread through the world. You can find Italian restaurants in the Himalayas, but Italians have yet to conquer their own land.
Fantastic. And we'll touch on a couple of themes that you mentioned there, particularly I think might be quite interesting to talk about this high tolerance of chaos. But before we do that, I want to ask you about the new generation of winemakers. And you spoke also about this connected world. I know that you moved to France in 2001. You wrote about a new generation of winemakers and you described that new generation and the wines that they're producing in your book, Corkscrewed. So can you tell us what inspired you to move to France in 2001? That sounds like quite a dramatic gear change. And what you discovered during your years in France?
Yes. Well, the reason for the move was my wife and I had lived in, of all places, North Texas for 15 years. I'd gone there for work, working for the now defunct newspaper, the Dallas Times Herald, and with an idea of being there for 2 years, which turned into 15. I also founded a weekly newspaper called FW Weekly or Fort Worth Weekly, which is still existent. After founding that paper, I really discovered I'm not a manager who likes to maintain something. Okay. So after the 5 years of the creation process, I sold that at a good time. And it was around our kitchen table in Fort Worth, Texas, that my wife and I were pondering our future with our 7-year-old son. She was born in Nice, France, grew up in California. And over a bottle of wine around the dinner table one evening, I said, why don't we try living in Nice? And we knew we were going to move, so we decided to go for it while we were still young. And you know, rather than waiting for retirement or some such thing like that.
A fantastic story, and I particularly like the fact the catalyst was that bottle of wine on the
yes,
table.
Yeah. And so when I got to the south of France, I mean, looking around and looking for something to write about, to continue writing, which is something I just have to do, it really struck me that what was really happening at that time was this regionalization and new awareness of small French wine regions. You know, it was no longer just Bordeaux, Burgundy, Champagne, but this similar process of new generation picking up their grandparents' work, a little bit of, technology that made boutique winemaking possible. And they were starting to make really good and interesting wines. And there was that whole natural wine thing that was taking hold at that time too, which was often good, often maybe not so good, but always interesting. You know, there was a real sense of people exploring their terroir from all over, you know, whether it was the Luberon Mountains, these little corners of the Rhone or southwest France, the Loire Valley, the Jura. It was all kind of happening. It was a great time to be there.
Yeah.
Are you enjoying this podcast? There is so much more high-quality wine content available from Mama Jumbo Shrimp. Check out our new wine study maps or books on Italian wine, including Italian Wine Unplugged and much, much more. Just visit our website, mamajumboshrimp.com.
Now, back to the show.
After 15 years, you decided to move again. You came to Verona with your obvious connections to the south of Italy. What made you choose Verona? Why were you inspired to come here to begin the next chapter of your life?
Well, another milestone of life. Our son had left home and gone to university. In my work and interest, I was spending more and more time in Italy because I saw more of the action moving here. Those same things that I saw happening in France and the OOs were taking hold in places like Italy, in the south of Italy. And my second book, Palmento, A Sicilian Wine Odyssey, focused on just this whole renaissance that was happening in Sicily. A lot of it on this new generation of crazy wine scene that was happening on Mount Etna. But I'm just more and more drawn to Italy. When people ask me the difference between the two, I sometimes say that France is much more organized and Italy is more fun.
Yeah.
And so I talked about it with my wife, the idea of moving to Italy, and she thought about it for a few days and she said, okay, but Rome and South is not possible. And I think she thought of it in terms of, you know, being a woman, the level of organization and blah, blah, blah. And so we love Verona. We've traveled here many times and it's a great strategic place that, you know, to go, you know, throughout Italy. I mean, in 3 hours, you're in Rome and by train. And,
yeah.
You know, 1 hour to Venice, 1 hour to Milan, 1 hour to the Alto Adige. It's a great strategic center, a great wine place. So that's how we ended up here.
Okay. Interesting. And yes, we'll come back to your experiences and your thoughts on Sicily in a moment. But let's take a second reading, Robert. This, I think, is from the chapter entitled Three Gentlemen of Abruzzo. And it focuses on this wonderful character, Emidio Pepe.
Yes, yes. Emidio Pepe is, of course, a wine legend for red wines. And in Abruzzo, he's quite up in years, a dapper gentleman. Legend in Abruzzo for his red wines. At the time of this reporting, he was about 85 years old, a patriarch with his daughters and granddaughter at beacon of red wine quality that is Vini Pepe. Pepe arrived in his summer work clothes and pointed with a weathered index finger to a picture frame containing one yellow typed page. On it was a list of wines, a simple report of the minutes of something called the Friends of Good Wine Club from Chicago in 1979. Look, Pepe said in Italian, breaking out of his usual dialect. His 85-year-old voice was as deep and raspy as a vintage car engine. This was from 1979, America, Chicago. The list was a ranking of Italian reds tasted by the club in February of that year. At the top of the list was Emidio Pepe Montepulciano, 1970. Eh, Pepe grunted for emphasis, as if to say, look at that. His finger descended the list, stopping at each of the other 9 wines that were tasted. Mostly Piedmont wines like the 1971 Barolo from the legendary traditionalist Giacomo Capilano and a 1971 Nebbiolo from Giacomo Conterno, along with Biondi Santi's 1973 Il Crepo Brunello di Montalcino. I was first before all of these, Pepe said. Barolo, Brunello, Biondi Santi, Chicago, he added. I've been to America 100 times. Emidio Pepe is obviously a man with a lot of pride and no small ego. He rarely drinks the wines of others and talks about few wines he admires outside of those produced by the winery of his late friend and fellow Abruzzo eccentric, Eduardo Valentini. I made better reds, Pepe said. He had soils and altitude and exposition that are better for the whites. But for reds, I always beat him. I followed Pepe out the back door and into the old Montepulciano vineyard that sloped down the hillside toward Torano. He explained his neatly prescribed formula, Uno Uno Uno, for cultivating pergola vineyards. The canopies of his vines were short-trimmed to provide what he says is the optimal ratio of one vine, 1 square meter of leaves, for 1 kilogram of grapes. It takes about 1.5 kilos to make a bottle of wine. As he walked in the shade under the vines, he tied up loose shoots and pulled dried ones that had been cut but left in the wire grid above. The result, he said, of sloppy work during the recent vine pruning. Look at this. You don't leave things like this, he complained, tugging on a long brown desiccated cutting and dropping it on the ground. Chiara, whose father Giuseppe works with Pepe in the vineyards, joined us and followed her grandfather's lead in tying up the loose ends. The workers are always making me angry, he cried into the heat of midday, with only me, Chiara, and a few cicadas to hear him. Then, after nearly a minute, he fumed, the workers are going to kill me. As he walked back up the hill, he veered from the vines into the rows of greens and tomatoes that Pepe also cared for, along with the family chicken. Perspiring from a morning of work, he proclaimed, the countryside is my gym, not just a gym for the physique, but for the mind also. As we entered the house for lunch, as if letting me in on a secret, he leaned in toward me and said in a low voice, you stop, you die.
Wonderful. What a character. I love this idea that he rarely drinks the wines of others.
Yes.
Why would you if you were producing wine of such quality? But it reminded me also, I once made the mistake of taking a bottle of French wine to my Italian father-in-law. The first time I met him, I arrived from France with a bottle of French wine. And for a proud Tuscan, this is obviously, I realize now, unacceptable. And the bottle of wine, it was a fine bottle of wine, but it remained unopened in his cabinet for many, many years.
Yes. I guess, I think it's interesting as a character, you know, as a strong character, a strong, stubborn character, you know, would be that way. But I think I really do appreciate winemakers who don't like to drink their own wine, who want to taste everything else. Right. And I think that's interesting too, because, you know, the thing about wine is it pulls us in. Wine should not be about drinking the same thing every night. It should be about drinking something different every night.
Yeah.
And that's what makes the wine world so interesting. I think it's really a golden age now where you can go down little rabbit holes and follow trails of in any direction you want, whether it's geographical, stylistically, whatever, white, red, and in between.
Yeah, absolutely. And one place where it's certainly a golden age is Sicily. So I want to bring you to Sicily now, Robert, and Etna in particular. You describe having a front row seat to the most dramatic rebirth of Etna wine, which in the space of these 20 years went from being a forgotten wine sold in plastic containers to the most famous wine in the south of Italy. What was it that you observed about Etna that allowed or enabled this renaissance to take place? Was it the producers? Was it the geography? Was it the market conditions?
Yeah. Well, look, I think it's really an accumulation of factors. Obviously, Etna is some pretty stunning volcanic terroir. And it's not just volcanic soils, but it's a volcano. So these things are actually always changing, you know, with every lava flow, every spewing of volcanic dust, and you have different altitudes and exposition. But terroir is nothing without people. I mean, you can have the best terroir in the world, and if you have people or producers who are not very curious, not very adventurous, not very driven, you might not have the quality or certainly the potential that you could have. What changed on Etna in the early 00s was a confluence of people, some from outside, that created a scene of friends, if you will, who were there tasting each other's wines, experimenting, and feeding off of each other. You had Marco Di Grazia, Italian-American, Andrea Franchetti, a Roman, Frank Cornelison, a Belgian crazy winemaker who went to Etna because he wanted to make wine without even using sulfur in the vineyards. They joined some of the people on Etna who had been working there, you know, for years, like the enologist Salvo Foti, Benanti, and many of the other families that were there. It just created the right mix of people with the right amount of new generation locals. I'm thinking of Giuseppe Russo, Alberto Gracci, Ciro Biondi, many others. I think the difference is, and I think it's been said in the book Palmento, some of these families that were out in Sicily, they were over these big dominions in the middle of Sicily. But when you're over a big dominion of, say, like 1,000 hectares in the middle of Sicily, it can be a fantastic place to grow grapes and make wine. But who do you talk to over coffee in the morning? Mm. Who do you, you know, at harvest time, who do you compare with? And that's what made Etna so exciting. Small parcels of land, small estates, you know, so it became a laboratory.
Yeah, it strikes me that there are parallels then with the experience in California during the birth, if you like, of Californian wine in the Napa Valley, and that coming together of people from different places. Is that a fair comparison or not?
I have to think about that for a minute, because I think that Napa right now is very, very staid. It's become, you know, one of the most staid places in the wine world based on two or three grapes. But I think that you're right that back in the day, there was that excitement over the Judgment of Paris, people striving, comparing, doing. And I think you find that perhaps in other places in the States, a little bit more of that experimentation, maybe more north in places like Sonoma. And I've written about this a bit in my column, the people that are, you know, trying to experiment with more and more and more outlier grapes, particularly Italian grapes.
Yeah, okay. Interesting. I want to switch topics slightly to talk about you as a writer, your writing habits. You're also a columnist. So can you give us a sense of where you write, when you write, what are your habits as a writer? Are you drinking something? Are you listening to music? You paint these really colorful portraits of characters in your book as well. So I was curious to know, when you meet these people, when you interact with these people, are you taking notes? Are you creating mental images in your head? How does your process as a writer work?
Well, I generally take notes. Sometimes I record if there's a sit-down interview. I try to also observe other things that are going on other than just what, you know, person is saying. You know, try to take notes of different things, like the plants, the weeds that are growing by the side of the vineyard. What are they? What kind of birds are singing?
Yeah.
So I try to take notes of a lot of little details, what we're eating, what's in the food, and generally, I would say writing. I like to write at home in the morning, as early as possible, because I think that's when the mind is fresh.
Yeah, okay, good. The observation that stuck in my mind that you use quite frequently is what people are wearing, whether it's sunglasses or a particular style of shirt or T-shirt or sneakers. And I think it is these little details that just help the reader to picture the scene rather than getting too focused on what's in the glass. You're painting a much broader canvas.
Yeah, well, and I also think, like, in Italy in particular, clothes are definitely an expression.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's funny. I just got back from California, and one particular thing I noticed is you have these T-shirts that have so many words on them. They're like entire sentences.
Yeah. It's become a trend, yeah. And definitely, you know, living in Italy, what people wear is a statement. They're so elegant. They're so refined. Even if they're casual, there's still a lot of thought going into what they're wearing. You won't see them in ill-fitting clothes, for example. Everything is made to measure. And I'm always struck when I go back to Scotland just how different that is. People are generally in baggy jeans, baggy T-shirts, and taking much less care about how they look. So, yeah, I think those little insights give a really vivid picture of what it is you're writing about and the characters behind the clothes, I suppose, as well. Okay, let's do the third reading, Robert, and then we'll finish up with what you're reading for pleasure at the moment. So this is from the chapter Volcano of Vulture, and it focuses on Elena Fucci, one of those young producers that you spoke about making organic wine around this extinct volcano in the Basilicata region.
Nothing much happens in Barile. After the sun reaches its daily zenith, the 3,000 denizens of this town at the instep of the Italian boot disappear from sight, as if in a southern slumber. The streets are left to roaming cats and lounging dogs. There wouldn't be a reason to pass through here if Barile didn't drape halfway up the eastern flanks of one of Italy's most compelling natural wonders, the dormant volcano Monte Voltore, which, from certain angles, appears to rise up from Basilicata's plains like the silhouette of a vulture in flight. Its inner core is full of life, having collapsed tens of thousands of years ago into a geological sinkhole, or caldera, filled by the green Valle dei Grigi and a pair of vast and deep spring-fed lakes. Barile's dominant group of settlers, as in most towns, arrived about 500 years ago with a wave of Christian Albanian refugees fleeing the Muslim Ottoman occupation of their homeland. In addition to taking up cultivation of these fertile dark soils, these Arbëresh settlers dug a honeycomb network of sasi, cave dwellings, in the volcanic tuff stone. The troglodyte societies of Basilicata are now famous because of the 3,000-year-old city of Matera, dug into a river canyon about 60 miles southeast of Barile. But they were hidden from the rest of the world until the relatively recent days after World War II. The man who brought them to light was the anti-fascist doctor and writer Carlo Levi, who was exiled by Mussolini in the 1930s to Basilicata and observed the wretched poverty, lack of sanitation, pestilence, and lawlessness of a people guided by a murky fusion of Christianity with primitive superstitions. In his 1945 book, Christ Stopped at Eboli, he likened Matera's caves to Dante's Inferno. The resulting scandal created programs in the 1950s to resettle Basilicata's cave dwellers in modern apartment blocks and houses. When the Italian poet and filmmaker Pier Paolo Pasolini filmed his Gospel According to St. Matthew in the early 1960s, he used Barile's Sassi as a setting for ancient Bethlehem, and to portray Palestine, he chose Matera, which was also used 40 years later in Mel Gibson's The Passion of Christ. While Matera's Sassi have seen a touristic renewal as a UNESCO World Heritage Site and a new generation of boutique inns and restaurants and bars, Barile's caves have remained abandoned and overgrown, or used in the making and storing of the area's best-known product, its potent Aglianico del Vulture red wine from its layered volcanic soils. Surrounded by orderly olive groves, wheat fields, vineyards, and grazing lands, Barile's population has been, like that of most of Basilicata, in steady decline for nearly seven decades. This despite modern efforts to keep new generations here, like the pair of factories in nearby Melfi that make Fiat cars and Barilla pasta. Dynamic is not a word that had been used much for either Barile or Aglianico del Vulture, which never quite achieved its hype potential as Italy's great next wine terroir. Then came Elena Fucci. At 37, she carried herself with the theatrical charisma that by 2018 had put her at the center of a new informal group of eight young, smart, and hip organic producers called Generazione Vulture, demanding attention in the southern wine wilderness. The key was in using Vulture's altitude and slopes to make wines with balance and elegance. Italian critics were already primed ready for the prophesied coming of great Vulture wines. A few had already hopefully christened the area the Barolo of the South. I arrived in Barile on a Saturday afternoon in June and met Elena and her husband, Andrea Manzani, a Florentine engineer who was drawn south by love giving up his old life for wine and Elena, who after a morning working in her winery, wore bright red lipstick and large bauble earrings, her dark eyes encircled with kohl. With her black Cleopatra bangs, green sneakers, and Gucci purse, she was a gypsy-like force of nature. A tiny woman, she seemed to nearly leap up in the air as she walked. Andrea was her foil, ambling, laconic, and casually assembled, with rumpled jeans and a winery polo stretched across his broad, well-fed frame. When he spoke, about half the speed of his wife, a wry grin crossed his wide-open, bearded face. "I am the slave of Elena Fucci," he said, introducing himself and holding up his wrists as if they were manacled. Then he shifted from Italian to English and added, "Human rights, goodbye."
Wonderful. Yeah, another fantastic passage, Robert. Again, these really vivid portraits of some fantastic characters. And Basilicata is a region I haven't yet had the fortune to visit, but it's definitely on my list.
Yes, it's a beautiful spot. Basilicata is amazing. How it's one of the least densely populated areas of Italy. It's wide open, it's clean, it's beautiful.
Yeah.
There's mountains, there's sea, there's everything.
So it's easy to see why you'd be drawn south for love.
Yes.
Okay. I want to switch, before we close, away from the world of wine to what you're currently reading. What's on your bedside table?
On my bedside table now, I have two books that have nothing to do with wine, incredibly.
Good.
One is kind of a heavy sociology book that I've just delved into at the recommendation of my son. It's Charles Taylor's A Secular Age. It's a super interesting book because it really contrasts how people would have thought and felt in the year 1500 versus the 21st century. A lot of the things we take for granted now, I think, are really explained in that book about how, you know, all the little choices we make and have to make now. Whereas 500 years ago, people didn't do that because they were sort of integrated in a system.
Yeah, interesting. And how nice to get a recommendation, a book recommendation from your son.
Yes.
I dream of the day when my son gives me a reading recommendation that isn't the Gazzetta.
And the second book that I'm reading simultaneously is called Prophet Song by the Irish writer Paul Lynch. And it's kind of a dystopian novel about how, you know, people start disappearing, police start showing up at doors and asking questions. But it's just kind of a fun, chilling sort of read that has nothing to do with wine.
Good. And yeah, I think it's important. I do a lot of wine reading and wine writing, but it's also good, I think, just to switch off that part of the brain and read something else. I also like to read books set in the place that I'm visiting. So I was recently in Bologna, and I picked up a copy of A Quiet Death in Italy by Tom Benjamin. It's an English writer, crime thriller that exposes the dark political underbelly of Bologna. So quite gritty, but a great choice if you're planning a visit to Bologna anytime soon. What's next for you, Robert, in terms of your writing, but also more generally? Have you good plans for the summer? Will you be visiting the South anytime soon?
Well, in fact, very soon, I plan to be going through Campania, exploring some new areas there that I haven't spent much time in around Cilento, and also returning to Vico Equense, where there is the first winery there.
Hmm.
A couple that's made some investments with a partner and is experimenting with some interesting wines. So I'm very curious to see what's going on there.
Yeah, I imagine you'll be a guest of honor.
Yeah, I suppose.
Okay, fantastic. Tell us, where can listeners get copies of your books? Where can they get a copy of South of Somewhere? And where can they follow you more generally?
I have a website, robertcamuto.com. The book South of Somewhere can be purchased anywhere you order books.
Okay, great.
Without saying their name.
Okay, fantastic.
Your favorite online seller.
Your favorite online supplier.
Do follow my column also. It's called Robert Camuto Meets. It's twice monthly at winespectator.com. That is free.
Yeah, highly recommended that column as well. Some really interesting stuff about what's going on in Italy, but also across the wine world more generally. Robert, Thank you so much for being my guest on Book Club.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Richard.
Thanks for your company today. Until next time, ciao, Robert. Ciao, tutti.
Ciao.
Thanks for joining the Italian Wine Podcast Book Club. Tune in again next month when we'll get between the vines with another great wine book. Remember, our show notes, including full details of all the books we've discussed today, are available at italianwinepodcast.com or wherever you get your pods.